We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. More than 70 people in states across the country, including Illinois, have become sick with salmonella poisoning that authorities suspect is connected with ground turkey. The first cases occurred in early March, and additional cases have continued to crop up every week. The Federal Centers for Disease Control estimates some 50 million Americans are sickened by foodborne illness every year, and salmonella is the most common cause. And there is concern among health officials that we have not made as much progress as perhaps we could and should in fighting it. And this part of Focus, we'll be talking about food safety. And our guest for the program is Guy Lonergan. He is an epidemiologist and also professor of food safety and public health at Texas Tech University. He's very much interested in food safety, in particular what people who raise animals can do to try to limit the spread of E. coli and salmonella. He's also interested in antimicrobial drug resistance. And we'll try to talk a little bit about all of these things this morning on the program. And we're certainly open to questions from people who are listening. We hope that people can just try to keep their comments brief and be on target with the topic. But if you could do that, certainly your questions and comments are welcome. So for people who are here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free number, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And there's also email, so if you'd like to send your question that way, you can do that by writing to willtalk at illinois.edu. How many years have I been doing it? And we'll be happy to take the questions that way. I better get the guest on here. Professor Lonergan, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Hey, well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. Well, you know, just to start out with the numbers, I think that it's true that CDC says that they think in a given year about 50 million people get sick from food poisoning, then that leads to maybe about 130,000 hospitalizations and maybe about 3,000 deaths. And I think there's probably good reason to believe that more people than that become sick, but perhaps they're not ill enough to seek out medical treatment, and those never get reported. So the question is, when you look at these numbers and you look at the numbers over time, can we at least say that we're making progress with dealing with foodborne illness, or is it really, are we not doing what we could be doing to try to limit this problem?
I think that's a very good question. If I could just quickly speak to those numbers that you said.
Sure.
Indeed, the CDC does provide estimates of the total number of illnesses, and it is somewhere in the vicinity of 50 million. Those estimates do include those people who aren't typically sick enough to seek help, the disease is mild enough that they resolve on their own. But that estimate really does include, as best they can, all people, all illnesses.
Oh, okay.
But I think it's important to realize that, in essence and in a broad scope, we do have a very safe food supply, but it's clear that we have the opportunity to improve it, and I think there's a lot of effort to improve it. And in many respects, if you look at the data that the CDC has been collecting, there has been reductions in many of the pathogens that cause food safety outbreaks and illnesses, but not all of them. So there are opportunities for improvement.
Yeah, I think the last time we talked about it in this particular program was near the beginning of the year, and I think that the occasion was the fact that the president was signing a new food safety law that had been passed. I believe this would have been in late 2010. And at that time, there were some numbers, and they were these numbers that I had given, and that in fact that they were lower than what had been kind of the standard numbers that people had been using before. So that it seemed that at least you could say that there was, by some, you know, perhaps tens of millions, assuming that the old numbers were good, that there had in fact been a reduction in the numbers of people who were getting sick from foodborne illness.
Yes, and if we break it down into what is causing people to be sick, so if we think of a foodborne pathogen that is quite widely known, so E. coli 0157, when the CDC has looked at its historical data and asked the question, what is the incidence today relative to the incidence in the 10 to 15 years ago, it looks like the incidence is about 50% lower, slightly less than 50% lower. So in some respects, there has been tremendous progress. Where we haven't seen much progress is with some other pathogens, such as Salmonella.
Yeah. Well, why is there some particular reason why, maybe at some point here or early on, we should talk a little bit about what these things are that we're talking about, Salmonella and E. coli. But is there a particular reason why Salmonella continues to be the leading offender here?
I think there are some potential reasons. One is that E. coli 01574 instance is a lot more straightforward in terms of its control. It appears really that it has one likely host, and that is ruminants, particularly cattle, as being the predominant one in the U.S., mm-hmm. whereas Salmonella has a multitude of different hosts, from poultry, as we're seeing today, to cattle, to a variety of other sources. And so there are many different sources that we attribute illnesses to for Salmonella, which makes it a little bit more complicated to control. And some of the improvements that we may see in one particular commodity might not show up as clearly when it comes to Salmonella.
Mm.
And you were right. There are many different types of pathogens. So if you go back to that initial comment of the 40 to 50 million Americans who are estimated to develop illness, the vast majority of those are caused by viruses.
Mm.
And so we may have seen or read about outbreaks of particular gastroenteritis in a cruise ship or whatever it may be. And that's mostly a virus called norovirus. And that causes the majority of illnesses. And then we have another group of microorganisms called bacteria. So that would include Salmonella, Campylobacter, E. coli 0157, Listeria, and they cause much fewer illnesses than the viruses do, but certainly their illnesses can be quite severe and oftentimes more severe than the viruses.
Right. So the two things here that we hear so much about now, and currently we're talking about a Salmonella outbreak here in the United States, and people remember not very long ago a pretty serious outbreak of E. coli in Europe. These two things are bacteria, and in both of these things live in the digestive tracts of the animals?
Well, yes and no. I think the two examples you highlight are very good examples to talk about. So the Salmonella outbreak at the moment, it's a particular strain of Salmonella called Salmonella Heidelberg, and it appears that this was resident in the intestinal tract of turkeys, and through a production system, which is, I would argue, very good but yet imperfect, some of that Salmonella Heidelberg makes its way onto the turkey carcasses, and then as the turkeys are processed into ground turkey, it may contaminate that ground turkey. So in that respect, there is likely a link between what the live animals had in their intestinal tract, but also what is on the product that we consumers buy. Whereas when we talk about the E. coli outbreak in Germany, that's a very interesting one and probably more closely resembles some of the viruses in that it's a particular strain of E. coli called an enteroaggregative E. coli, and it appears that the host for that is human.
Hmm.
So if it follows the textbook rules, and quite often bacteria don't follow the textbook rules, but the most likely source is that the seeds that were used to produce the sprouts in Germany were actually contaminated by a sick human somewhere back at the source, and it looks like the likely source is Egypt. And so when we talk about the viruses, say, that's usually a human-to-human or human-to-a-food product or a surface product, a hand railing or something, and then to another human. Whereas when we talk about, say, Salmonella in the current situation or E. coli 0157, that's often an animal-to-food product or animal-to-environment, then to human.
Yeah. So the mechanisms that you'd have to use to try to limit the spread then would be going to be very different in the two cases.
Yes, and ultimately the first step is that we need to detect that something's going wrong. So 77 illnesses from March until July is an important outbreak, but it's not necessarily straightforward to detect. Typically, what would happen is that the people who are ill need to be ill enough to go and see the doctor. The doctor would then need to perceive that that patient is ill enough to order a test, not to just provide them some empiric drug and send them home. And then that test has to include the right assays for the right bacteria. And then those samples would then go into the state health lab and then to the CDC. And then ultimately the federal government, the CDC, Center for Disease Control and Prevention, would have to have a system to actually tie all these dots together to say, hey, listen, there's an outbreak going on. So it's actually quite complex in terms of finding some of these outbreaks. And as soon as you start an outbreak, the next step really follows very similarly, regardless of the source, in that you would do a study to try and determine what are the likely sources of infection. And so in this instance, it was ground turkey for Salmonella, most likely. In Germany, it was sprouts. But we've seen many different sources, whether it's water in Oklahoma recently, or it is lettuce or spinach for E. coli 0157 and so forth. So it really is a complex process, and it's frustrating that it doesn't move faster, but I think it moves relatively fast for how complex it is.
Well, that just gets at what was going to be my next question, and in fact, I got a question, really essentially the same question from someone here who is listening who sent in the question by email. And that's it takes note of the fact that the first cases of sickness associated with this outbreak seem to have occurred in early March, and that I think the most recent there were still reported cases being reported in June, and there's a number of questions here. First of all, how is it that it seems that the turkey that has been implicated here probably, and we'll say that this is still a matter of, it's not certain, came out of a plant in Arkansas, and the Cargill company has now voluntarily recalled something like 36 million pounds of ground turkey, which is said to be the biggest, perhaps the biggest meat recall ever. So it looks like all of this, it seems to be the case that it's linked to the turkey produced in this one plant. But I think the question is that, you know, how is it that it took 5 months to figure out what was going on here and to notify the public? And that's what the emailer says here. You know, he says, I consider myself to be well-informed, reading news and so forth, yet the first I heard of this outbreak was this week. And he asks the question, has the media dropped the ball on getting the word out? One might also raise a question about the federal government and whether it had dropped the ball in getting the word out.
Yeah, and I think that's a fair criticism and a fair question. If we go and look at what we would call the epidemic curve, or how many cases by the week of onset, right now in the first week of this outbreak, they think there were two events across the country linked to this outbreak. And so if you really sort of think about that, it's very hard out of 300 million Americans to link two cases across 26 different states, as ultimately the outbreak was. But by the time we got to the first week of June, they're estimating there was approximately 11 cases in that week. And so at some stage, there needs to be enough data and cases that filter through to the CDC for them to say, hey, listen, we're seeing illnesses that are above what we would typically see, because there are a lot of background illnesses too. And so I share the frustration and the criticism, but I also think that this is an opportunity to ask the question, do we have the best surveillance system? And I don't think anyone would say we do. There are certainly lots of opportunities for improvement. But over the last 15 years, the CDC has certainly developed an improved degree of sophistication that they're now able to detect outbreaks earlier and quicker. I think what makes this Salmonella one so challenging is that it is a very long outbreak. So the illness has occurred quite sporadically, if you will, in ones and twos and threes across weeks for a long period of time. If this was an outbreak with 77 people that occurred over, let's say, a month or less, then you have a lot more cases occurring a lot more quickly, and that makes it a little bit easier to identify.
Mm. Well, and I think that some people would also, as a complicating factor, they would point to the kind of food production that we have now, where we have large plants that are producing a lot of product and then shipping them across the country. And I think in this particular case, people in 26 states became ill. So I'm sure that makes it more complicated to figure out what's going on. If you have people getting sick in Indiana and California and Utah and Massachusetts and Georgia, and I don't know whether people in those states were sick. But just to make the point that if you have people scattered all over the country, it makes it much more difficult to try to pull all that together.
Absolutely. So if you actually look at the state-by-state map, there's one in Minnesota, one in Iowa, one in Oklahoma, one in Oregon. And at some stage, the state-level public health departments have to send the information on those single cases to the federal government, who has to then tie all these single events in a state together. And yes, it's complicated, and yes, it's frustrating, but what's surprising or interesting is that there are actually no reported cases yet in Arkansas. And so I think it's a good opportunity to also talk about the production systems in the U.S. And I think we can bemoan the fact that plants have gotten bigger and more efficient, and the distribution chain is much more complex than it used to be. But while there are potential downsides of that, there certainly are potential upsides of that, in that over the years, particularly for the last 20 years, with the introduction of what we would call HACCP, or Hazard Analysis and Critical Control Points, by the USDA Food Safety Inspection Service, which has authority over the meat and poultry as well as processed eggs, it has required that plants do a critical evaluation of their process, identify what the hazards are, so say Salmonella or E. coli, and then also identify what they would consider the critical control steps that they must control in the process, and then put verifiable interventions in them. And over the last 15 to 20 years, the industry has invested many, many hundreds of millions of dollars into these interventions. And ultimately, the larger plants are able to invest more into these interventions and the development, as well as implementation of some of these processes. So, for instance, in the beef production process, as the animals go into the plant immediately after they're stunned and are euthanized, they go through, in some plants, a large, very sophisticated hide washing cabinet, which appears to be extremely effective. But these cabinets are in the order of $5 to $7 million each. So there's certainly an economy of scale that the larger plants are able to invest more in some of these more advanced technologies.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Guy Lonergan. He's an epidemiologist and professor of food safety and public health at Texas Tech University, and has done a lot of research on epidemiological approaches to food safety. In particular, he's interested in what happens before animals end up at the processing plant. He's interested in looking at what can be done to mitigate E. coli and Salmonella at the places where the animals are raised, and that's something that I'm sure that we'll talk about. Questions are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, a good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send something by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's somebody in Decatur to talk with here, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I've always been curious what happens to the meat and the eggs when they get recalled. Do they just grind up the meat and reprocess it and sell it as dog food? And then the eggs, do they just grind those up, reprocess, sell them as powdered eggs, or what?
any recalled product would be considered adulterated or recalled for some other reason, and all the product that they receive would be either landfilled or incinerated or destroyed in some other way.
Thanks.
So no use at all, human, animal, otherwise, from that point on?
No, and I think there's good reason for that. Obviously, we would not have a product that's considered adulterated. You can never... it certainly would be destroyed. It's been out of their control. So, for instance, if a company decides to sell a product, it's into commerce, and then there's a problem with it, and then they recall it, for the time period that was in commerce, whether in a supermarket or a consumer's home, they have lost control of what is happening to that product. And so, naturally, they would want to destroy that product. And there's also good reason why we wouldn't necessarily want to send it straight to, say, turning it into pet food, in that there has been outbreaks of salmonella and other diseases in humans associated with handling pet food products. Mm-hmm. And I would think that plants now would see that that certainly could compound the problem. If they bought back a salmonella-positive product and sold it for pet food manufacturing and it created another outbreak via pet food, I think that would be extremely problematic. Mm.
Well, again, other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Here in this particular case, we've been talking about this current outbreak that seems to be linked to ground turkey. Here the culprit is ground meat. And I think also there have been problems. We know there have been problems associated with ground beef and E. coli. That suggests that this particular product and the way that it is processed, the fact that it's ground meat, may also be an issue. And I think that it is true, and you could tell me if it's right, that maybe you're more likely to encounter E. coli in a hamburger than in a steak, for example. Is there something in particular about this product, that a ground meat product, that makes it more problematic?
Great question, David. And I think this is a good point for discussion, that most of the bacteria that we deal with meat or poultry is on the surface of the carcass or the steak, if you will.
Uh-huh.
And when we take that steak and we either chop it or grind it, basically what we're doing is taking what was on the surface and then distributing it evenly through it. So if you think about a steak with a that may have a little bit of fat on the outside and it's very lean in the middle, when you grind it, you want to homogenize that so that there's an even distribution of say, beef and fat in it. So you might get a product that's 95% lean and 5% fat, or whatever it is. We see it at the supermarket. The challenge with that is that the bacteria on the outside, which are very easily killed by simple cooking because the heaters on the outside, are now in the middle, so it takes a little bit more to kill some of those bacteria. So that's why we often see warnings or recommendations on labels that ground or non-intact product, as we would call it, needs to be cooked to a certain internal temperature.
I want to make sure we talk a little bit here about the one area that I know that you are interested in, because one of the things that you do is you work with people who raise cattle and are interested in what happens with the animals at that point, when they're being raised, before they end up at the plant. And it seems that a lot of the attention on this issue has been on the plants where meat is processed, and for good reason there should be attention on that. But is there more, do you think, that could be done to try to limit the spread of these things, salmonella and E. coli, at the place where the animals are raised?
Yes, so I think to go back to something you said, I think there was very, very good reason that most of the interventions did occur at the plants, in that in the U.S., for instance, there's approximately 30 to 35 beef processing plants that process in excess of 90% of all beef in the U.S. So if you develop something that works really, really well, then you only need to implement it 30 times across the country. Whereas now when we talk about where cattle are raised, there's approximately 800,000 family-owned ranches and dairies in the U.S. that where cattle cattle are born and raised. And so it's a little bit more complicated. But what we've seen is that the plants really have got to a point that they've got very good process control. It's certainly not perfect, as we've heard about this morning, and it does fail, as we've heard about this morning. But the ability to continue to do major improvements at the plant is starting to become limited because what they can do, they've largely done. So it's natural now that the industry as well as the plant start to look upstream and ask the question about if we do something differently to those animals during their the period they're raised, will that help improve the overall process control? And ultimately what we all want is improved public health. And so for the last 15 years, several companies have been looking at developing basically technologies that may improve the safety of product, whether it's Salmonella or E. coli 0157 or Campylobacter. And these may range from probiotics like we might find in yogurt that we can select and test, or vaccines against E. coli or Salmonella, or other approaches to control, say, Campylobacter in poultry. And we're at a point now that with all the investment and the successes and failures, we're starting to see products that appear to be quite efficacious and that they are working their way through the regulatory approval process, whether that's USDA or Food and Drug Administration. And these products are now starting to become available to producers that appear to predictably reduce, say, E. coli 0157 in groups of animals that we could send to an abattoir. But the other interesting point is that they also would reduce the amount of, say, E. coli or Salmonella that may be shed into the environment as the animal is walking through the pasture and defecates. Then certainly it would reduce the amount of E. coli that route, which is important because about two-thirds of E. coli cases are caused by non-beef sources such as lettuce and water sources. So I think these interventions that people have invested in and now they've gone through development, now regulatory approval, appear to be efficacious. They're becoming available. And the next question that we're trying to ask is, okay, if we implement them in industry, can we actually affect improved public health? And that's a lot more challenging question to answer. But there are a lot of good people working on that right now.
Well, just to make sure now people understand here, again, we just go back to the basic idea that what we're talking about here is a bacteria. In the case with cattle, for example, you were talking about a bacteria, E. coli, that exists in their digestive tract, and one of the ways that it and that people get it, although as you say that you can have human, it can have a human host and it can be spread from person to person, but it's in the digestive tract of the animal that it can be on their outside, and somehow in the process of processing it can get into the meat. So you're saying that we're looking at things that can be fed to the animal as a part of their usual diet that can limit the amount of the bacteria that actually is in the digestive tract?
Absolutely. So in the research that we have been doing here at Texas Tech with many different partners and from government to academia across the country, we have looked at a probiotic product called Bovamine, which is basically a lactobacillus or a good bacteria, much like what we would find in yogurt. And given that particular product, we can, over the last decade, we find that it repeatedly reduces the amount of E. coli shed by about 50%. And then we've also spent a lot of time working on vaccines, and there's a product available at the moment that appears to be very efficacious, reducing E. coli by somewhere in the order of 60 to 80%. So this is another product that appears to be very effective too. And so what we're starting to get to at the moment is that there are a variety of different interventions that may be available to suit different production practices, in that cattle are raised in many, many different environments across all 50 states in the U.S. Sometimes they may be in a feedlot, sometimes most of the time they're on a pasture, and then before they go to the plant, they go to a feedlot, or they're in a dairy. So there's lots of different types of production systems. So we really need a variety of different tools that may fit one more than the other. And we're starting to see that they're becoming available, and particularly efficacious ones, too.
In this hour of Focus, we're talking with Guy Lonergan from Texas Tech, and we're talking about food safety and foodborne illness. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us on the program tomorrow. Well, maybe I better do hour two today. Hour two today, the 11 o'clock hour, it's our monthly show on computers. We try to do this on a regular basis because we know people will always have questions about these machines that are so much a part of our lives. So if you're having a problem, you can call in and talk with Peter Kimball. He's computer-assisted instructor specialist with the Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. Then tomorrow in the 10 o'clock hour, I'll talk with music critic Simon Reynolds about his book Retromania, Pop Culture's Addiction to Its Own Past. And also we'll have another of our regulars, Dog Care and Dog Behavior, and again, Celeste Quinn will host that show. And her guests will be dog trainers Carol Lindholm and Jim Keel. That's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon with 10 different topics. You can look at the schedule and listen to past programs by going to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, we are talking with Guy Lonergan. He's an epidemiologist and professor of food safety and public health at Texas Tech University, and he's interested in food safety, particularly looking at what happens with the way that animals are raised and what you can do before they end up at the processing plant to try to limit the spread of problems that go with these bacteria. We're talking about E. coli and Salmonella. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Just maybe one other thing, and I don't know if this it will end up being a little outside of your area, but it does seem to be kind of striking that over time, when you look at foodborne illness, that produce items have become a bigger problem, perhaps bigger than problems with poultry and meat and eggs. And so you have to ask this question, well, why is it that these bacteria that exist in the digestive tracts of animals, human animals and chickens and turkeys and cows, how is it that they're getting into produce items, which can really be problematic because those are things that we eat without cooking them?
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't know that produce is, I certainly don't think produce is getting worse by any stretch of the imagination, but I think what is happening is that as our understanding and our sophistication in detecting and attributing outbreaks to a particular cause, we have fewer and fewer outbreaks from an unknown cause, and we're now able to attribute it to a cause, as well as we improve food safety of meat and poultry, then that proportion goes down, and so proportionately produce may look like it's going up. Mm. But so, yes, we do see that the bacteria that we commonly find in the intestinal tract of animals does cause outbreaks with consumption of produce, and you hit the point, it's not cooked. And so then how in the process does it get there and how do we control it becomes the next question. And if you think about how we grow lettuce, we plant a seed in the soil and we want it to grow, but if we want it to grow effectively and quickly, we have to provide the nutrients that are needed by that plant, and the best source of nutrients is often manure. And so in organic produce production or whatever it is, we would use composted animal manure because it is extremely rich in nutrients. And those of us who grow our own vegetable gardens know that it's a very effective tool, the composted manure. And if it's imperfectly composted or even perfectly composted, it's not a perfect process. And so we can still have bacteria there. But also, as we irrigate these fields, it's certainly possible that bacteria from animal intestines may get into the irrigation water that is used. And these fields are quite often open, so we can have wild animals such as feral hogs trudge across cattle pastures and may pick up a bacteria that is very distantly remote to the lettuce-growing field. And then as they walk through the field, they might transport that bacterium into that field. So there's a variety of avenues by which produce may become contaminated with bacteria from an animal source.
We have another caller here, somebody on our line number one. So we will go there and talk with them. Hello.
Yeah, hello. Yeah. Unless I'm mistaken, E. coli grows equally well in vegetable matter as it does in fecal matter, which is nothing more than vegetable matter usually that has been digested by a body's food system. There at one time had been a very simple test to determine which was vegetable and which was fecal in nature, but that's got nothing much to do with salmonella, I think. The outbreaks with the lettuce, I believe, were traced back to reusing wash water to wash the lettuce. And but can you make a easy description as to the physical results of salmonella from aging eggs, salmonella from an old hamburger, and the botulism we don't hear much of, but gee, I hope nobody uses an exploded can of vegetables. I'll listen on radio.
It is absolutely correct that bacteria can survive outside the host, whether that's an animal or a human. I think the difference would be that it certainly grows most effectively in the host. So its ideal environment is within the intestine. It's at a constant temperature, and it's got nutrients being delivered to it all the time in the fecal material. And that really is where it grows fastest and best. It certainly can grow or even maybe if it's not growing, exist in the environment or on lettuce. But certainly, based on what we know, Salmonella, E. coli will amplify and grow much more quickly in the intestine. And you're right. So there has been outbreaks associated with lettuce with Salmonella that appears to be because of the water that is used to wash the lettuce, because much of that lettuce is actually washed in the field. But ultimately, that Salmonella had to get into the wash water at the beginning, and it likely did through contaminated lettuce that was contaminated with animal source bacteria. Yes, and when we look at Salmonella in the different meat and poultry products, we do see that it's commonly Salmonella, but there are many, many different types of Salmonella. And so the Salmonella that we're seeing in the current poultry outbreak is Salmonella Heidelberg, and that appears to be more commonly found from poultry products. So for eggs, we would typically see a one called Salmonella enteritidis, and we commonly see Salmonella Kentucky in poultry production systems. Whereas in the beef system, it's slightly different. We quite often see when we have illnesses with Salmonella, it is more likely going to be a Salmonella Newport or a Salmonella Typhimurium. And while these are all Salmonella and they're all very much related to each other, there are important differences that we might not completely understand, but they certainly do explain that we see different Salmonellas in different hosts. Hmm.
Well, let me ask you this question, and this is more of a plant question, but if we're talking about a plant, spinach, lettuce, sprout, something like that, that is contaminated with one of these bacteria, is the bacteria, does it somehow get into the tissues of the plant, or is it on the surface of the plant so that if you washed it well enough, a surface treatment would take care of the problem? Or is it a case that it might actually be in the plant so that it's not something that you could wash off?
I think the answer to that is all of the above.
Ah.
So it does get on the surface, and washing produce is obviously recommended. But bacteria can learn to stick to the surface very, very well too. So washing sometimes won't remove all bacteria, particularly if it has adhered or adhesed to the outside. But if there are bruises or damages to the plant, certainly the bacteria can become internal into the plant as well, which would mean that washing is in that respect, ineffective. And so if you think about yes to all of the above, then it becomes even more important to look at produce production and develop similar HACCP plans that they have in the beef production system, which the produce growers are currently doing, and then better control the process as well as what we're seeing, and you mentioned earlier too, in that we're modernizing some of the regulatory agencies such as the FDA so we can better deal with today's challenges in the produce industry.
Yeah. Well, that perhaps I could ask you for a moment just to talk about that issue. And I mentioned again that there was that late last year that the Congress passed a new food safety law, and one of the provisions was that there would be stepped up inspection by the FDA. And that it was my understanding that at that point that most producers were inspected about once every 10 years. And it was just that there were a lot of producers and there were only so many inspectors. And that what the new law would require would be that facilities that were identified as being at high risk, and it was not entirely clear to me what that meant, that they would be visited every 5 years, and then it's possible if problems were found, they could be visited as frequently as every three. So this gets to the question of the adequacy of inspections and whether there are enough inspectors and they're spending enough time in the plants where the food is processed so that we can try to limit the spread of these kind of problems.
Yeah, and that's a very good question, because the way that the inspections work are really framed by the laws and the rules as they're written. And in terms of the FDA, the food safety side of it, the rules were really written a long time ago. So in a lot of respects, inspection was constrained by what was very good historically but may not have been so good presently. And so the Food Safety Modernization Act did address this by saying, well, what has changed in production and what are the risks now? And one of the big things that they will be doing is, as you indicated, developing a risk-based surveillance. So those production practices or companies or products that appear to be overrepresented in terms of food safety risk would be more heavily or more frequently inspected. But still, the agency is not going to have sufficient inspectors to look at every production facility every year. I was told just at a recent meeting by an FDA person that if they moved everyone from the FDA that's doing drug approval to whatever they do to inspection, it would still take 10 years to inspect every plant growing area in the country. And so I think what they've done is realize that they have a finite amount of resources and they need to address those or allocate those resources to those areas that are most risky. But it's also, this Modernization Act allows the FDA to ask the producers to modernize their production practices, particularly how they have process control. And we've seen that from the other regulatory agency, the Food Safety Inspection Service that does meat and poultry, they were able to ask this of their producers approximately 15 years ago. So a lot of it is updating the rules and regulations to reflect an understanding where we have some risky products and some products that are probably less risky, and we need to allocate our resources to those.
We have a bit under 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Let me just again quickly introduce the guest, Guy Lonergan. He's an epidemiologist and professor of food safety and public health at Texas Tech University. And we're talking about food safety. Specifically, we're talking about foodborne illness. and what can be done to limit the spread of problems like E. coli and salmonella. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We just have, as I said, maybe about 7-8 minutes left in the program, and I want to talk about another area, and probably it's worthy of more discussion than just 10 minutes, but that has to do with antibiotic resistance and how it is that that is a growing problem, and that there are some links to the way that animals are for food are raised, and it is apparently, according to the government, a significant portion of the contaminated product. For example, here I'm reading here from a story from the New York Times that federal data shows 10 to 15% of ground turkey, for example, we'll just take ground turkey, is typically contaminated with salmonella, and that federal data from tests conducted in 2009 showed that 3/4 of salmonella samples found on ground turkey was resistant to at least one type of antibiotic. And that's a real problem. If somebody gets sick, that limits your treatment options. And that the issue here seems to be antibiotics that are given to animals not because they're sick, but on a prophylactic basis, as they are raised. What can you say about that?
If I can just slightly introduce this problem to give some perspective, most of the antibiotics that we use in human medicine or animal medicine or animal production are actually derived from bacteria themselves.
Hmm.
So as bacteria compete in the environment, in the soil, or in the intestinal tract of animals, they need to compete against other bacteria. So they produce antibiotics. And for the other bacteria to actually protect themselves, they would develop mechanisms to resist those antibiotics. So in many respects, antibiotics as well as antibiotic resistance has been around as long as bacteria have, for many, many, many millions of years. I think the difference, what we're talking about now, is that instead of this being a biological fight between two bacteria, we have purified, modified, and produced these antibiotics and now use them in human and animal medicine at a much higher level than what would be used in nature. And so any use of antibiotics will select for bacteria that are less sensitive to that antibiotic. And that's exactly the way antibiotics work. They're going to eliminate the bacteria that are sensitive or reduce the numbers of those that are sensitive. And those that are less sensitive or even resistant will increase in number to take that place. And so it's effectively giving those ones that are less sensitive a competitive advantage. And so I think we have to look at all uses of antibiotics and ask the question, are they necessary, and what is the public health benefit and public health risk of using the antibiotics? So, for instance, for a long time, there was concern about over-prescription of antibiotics to children with ear infections. And as a parent of two young boys who both have had ear infections, it's not enjoyable to watch a little boy in pain with ear infection. So certainly wanting it to be resolved certainly helps drive antibiotic use. But a lot of those ear infections will resolve on their own. And so now we have to, as a society, start asking questions about that, and CDC is certainly helping and leading that task. But we also need to ask it about animal production as well, in that we use antibiotics for really three different purposes. One is to treat animals that get sick. Just like humans, animals occasionally get sick and require antibiotics to get better. We can also have instances where we think there's an outbreak of, say, respiratory disease about to start in a group of cattle. And based on a lot of research, we know that if we treat those animals, say, with an injectable antibiotic, we can reduce the level of sickness by at least 50% and oftentimes more. And then the third one is what you talk about. It's the production level use, which is essentially treating non-ill animals for a particular production purposes. And so, for instance, monensin, which is a type of an antibiotic, is used to improve the efficiency of production. It doesn't make the animals grow faster, they actually just eat slightly less food but grow at the same rate. So it's like getting a more fuel-efficient car. And the benefit of that is that we dramatically reduce our carbon footprint of production. The risk would be what happens if we develop resistant organisms. And when we talk about Monensin, it's not used in human medicine, and so that's not really a concern. But then we talk about other drugs that are used in both animal and human medicine, and that becomes more of a concern. And so what our research is doing is that we're trying to ask the question about if we use these antibiotics in these ways in animal production, what is the extent of the problem? And then we're trying to work through, in collaboration with others, better understand what is the consequence of that problem, but also look at what is the benefit of that use too, so that on a broader sense we can weigh the benefits of the use versus the risks of the use. And if it appears the risk outweighs the benefit, then I think everyone would agree that we need to prevent that use moving forward.
Hmm. Well, I think probably most people would support, or at least would say, well, I understand the use of an antibiotic if given to an animal that we know is sick, or if there's good reason to believe, you know, we have a herd, there's some illness and we don't want it to spread out of control to make a lot of animals sick. I think people say, okay, I understand that. I think that the issue is with the antibiotics that are given to just help the animals grow faster. That's a production input. That's not because the animals are sick. I think that's the thing that people are maybe most concerned about. And we can get into all kinds of other questions about about food and diet and animals and so forth. But you're saying that at least on that particular question, you think that that's still something of an open question. Antibiotics given that for that reason, that way, we still are weighing up the pros and cons?
Yes, and I think for good reason people are critical about that use, and we need to reevaluate that use. But what I would like to see is on a case-by-case basis that we're very open to ask the question, or we need to be open to ask the question, that with any use there is risk, and with any use there is benefit. And so we need to not focus solely on either the benefit or the risk, but we need to weigh those against each other. And if it looks like the benefit outweighs the risk, well, those data are telling. But if the risk outweighs the benefit, we need to be prepared to say we shouldn't use it in that way.
Hmm. Well, how much longer do you think it's likely to take before we maybe get some better answers about this?
Well, antimicrobial resistance is extraordinarily complex, and I keep reminding my graduate students that if you think you understand antimicrobial resistance, it hasn't been explained to you properly. And it's extraordinarily complex. But we're getting closer. We're certainly getting to a point now that we are developing some models, or groups developing models, that can weigh the benefit and the risk. So I am very optimistic and hopeful that in the next few years we'll have better answers to some of these questions.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. My apologies. We have a caller that we can't take because we're here at the end of the time. I'm sure, though, it's something that we will talk about again. But for the moment, we need to say thanks to our guest, Guy Lonergan. He is an epidemiologist and also professor of food safety and public health at Texas Tech University. Professor Lonergan, thanks very much for talking
with us. Thank you. It was a privilege for me to be part of this program.